The headlines: U.S. President Joe Biden defends his order for airstrikes in eastern Syria despite widespread criticism at home and abroad. Yemeni army says it has launched missile and drone attacks on Saudi Arabia's capital Riyadh and warns of further retaliatory attacks. And Iran begins the clinical trial of its second domestically developed coronavirus vaccine. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories in this hour. U.S. President Joe Biden has sent a letter to Congress explaining his justification for Thursday's airstrikes in eastern Syria, close to the Iraqi border. In that letter, Biden said that aerial raids were carried out in self-defense, adding that they meant to protect U.S.-led foreign troops in Iraq against rocket attacks. The attack targeted the positions of Iraqi counterterrorism forces. The U.S. has time and again blamed Iraqi resistance groups for targeting American mission and forces. The assault on Syria was the first of its kind under the new U.S. administration. However, it has been criticized by some Democrats in the U.S. Congress. The raid has also sparked international condemnations. International human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan says Biden's justification is senseless and the attack on Syria is an act of aggression.
You know, Joe Biden describes this as, you know, self-defense. If this is self-defense, then I'd like to sell you some land on the moon, because this is not self-defense. This is an act of aggression. But also, it doesn't make sense because the people they attacked are actually fighting, you know, Daesh, the Islamic State, which were the most effective forces fighting the Islamic State, as are these other groups. Iran and Iraq and Syria have all been fighting the Islamic State. And the United States says they fight it, but when you look at what they do, they keep bombing the Syrians, keep bombing the Iraqis. They assassinate the, you know, General Soleimani and other leaders that have been actually most effective in fighting the Islamic State. So it really rips off the cover and shows the United States is using and supporting ISIS and Daesh. The Americans are punching, and I guess Biden is sending a message. But, you know, I don't know what sort of message is going to be sent by the military forces and popular mobilization units in Iraq and other organizations and units that are fighting Daesh. But the United States seems to be trying to reestablish Daesh in the area to give them a pretext to stay in the area. They're illegally in Syria. They're building a military base there, and they're stealing oil. Mm-hmm. All of these things make no sense, and in fact, are clearly illegal under international law.
Syria calls on the United Nations Security Council to take measures to stop what it calls U.S. acts of aggression against the Arab country. In a letter addressed to the U.N. Secretary General and President of the Security Council, the Syrian Foreign Ministry condemned the recent U.S. airstrikes on Iraqi anti-terror resistance groups on the Syrian border. The ministry warned that such actions can escalate tensions in the region. The U.S. attack also drew condemnation from the director of Iran's Supreme National Security Council. Ali Shamkhani slammed the raid as an act of organized terrorism aimed at boosting Daesh terrorists. Shamkhani made these remarks during a meeting with visiting Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein. Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, the Yemeni army says that it has conducted a large-scale drone and missile strike operation against sensitive targets in Saudi Arabia. Army spokesman Yahya Sari says ballistic missiles and over a dozen drones were used in the operation deep inside the kingdom. Sari also said that the overnight strikes hit targets at three sites, including those in the Saudi capital Riyadh and the southern city of Abha. He warned that military operations against Saudi-led coalition will continue and expand until a siege on Yemen is lifted. The attacks follow those on Abha Airport less than a month ago. The Yemeni army frequently launches drones and missiles into Saudi Arabia. That is in retaliation for 5 years of Saudi-led aggression that has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis and pushed the country to the brink of famine. Now, in order to discuss that further, we're joined by Mr. Tim Anderson, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, joining us live from Sydney, and also Mr. John Stepling, author and commentator, joining us from Norway. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen. Now, let's begin with Mr. Anderson. These strikes are sending a message to Saudi Arabia. Do you think they're getting that message?
Yes, I think they are. Strikes on military bases in southwest Saudi Arabia are a continuation of previous strikes, and the armed forces of Yemen have made it very clear that these are until the attacks on the civilian centers in Yemen cease. So it's an effective way of trying to roll back the aggression that the Saudis have been punishing the Yemeni people with for the last 6 years.
So Mr. Stepling, Mr. Anderson believes that the Saudis are actually getting the message. Have you seen any signs of that? And let's not forget that the U.S. has also, at least in words, said that it is not backing this war any longer.
Well, yeah, what the U.S. says is relatively meaningless because, you know, they say anything they feel like at the moment because they view all of this as a kind of exercise in perception management. And public opinion turned against this aggression sometime about a year ago. Previously, it was off the radar for at least the American public. And the thing is, Biden takes office and immediately starts bombing in Syria, moves troops over there. He's clearly going to return to the attempts to remove Assad and what he does with the Saudis in Yemen is an open question, but I can't imagine that he will throw bin Salman under the bus about this. But you know, with the question that looms over all of this, retaliation, aggression, all that, is why this aggression ever took place in the first place. I mean, Yemen is the poorest country in the Arab world. They are now just reduced to rubble. I mean, it's a massive, almost unimaginable humanitarian catastrophe. There have been outbreaks of cholera. I don't know, I forget the figure, the number of millions of people that have been displaced. And the Saudis bombed hospitals. They bombed water for purification plants. They committed all manner of war crime. But the U.S. protects the Saudis, and this is more or less kept off of the media. But why is it still going on, and what is there left for the Saudis to achieve? In a sense, they've been defeated already, because nothing has changed really in Yemen other than the fact they've inflicted enormous suffering on the people. But you know, the raison d'etre was somehow that this was connected to Iran. No proof was ever established. Iran offered rhetorical support for Yemen, but the Houthis, but there's no proof of anything more than that. So the whole thing is always has felt to me like a reason to use up U.S. you know, weaponry. Use up the bombs and then you can buy more bombs, because there's no perceivable reason for the Saudis to keep inflicting this kind of suffering on the Yemenis. I don't understand it at a certain point, and public opinion is very much against it. So
thank you very much. Now back to Mr. Anderson. Mr. Anderson, do you actually, Mr. Stepling pointed out to the fact that this war is already lost. The Saudis themselves have time and again mentioned that they never expected this war to take so long. How long do you think they will continue, knowing that this was not the easy war that they were expecting.
Yes, they're looking for a way out. That's certainly the case. There have been a series of military defeats. Despite the damage inflicted on the Yemeni population, the capacity of the Yemeni armed forces to resist has been substantial and perhaps unexpected in many quarters, despite the weapons that the U.S. has sold to the Saudis. Now, about 2 years ago, they started trying to talk to, or having peace talks brokered through Oman at one stage with Iran, basically. They were sort of looking for an intermediary way out. And nothing much came of that, but since then there's been a number of strikes on military sites and airports in Saudi Arabia. And so, plus I think it's not entirely clear that MBS is going to survive in Saudi Arabia. President Biden has now, raised the issue of the murder of the Saudi man in Turkey. And it's possible that they may change puppets in Saudi Arabia because they have a public relations problem because there has been this change in public opinion in the U.S. Remember also that President Biden has renounced the idea of supporting the Saudi war on Yemen, but has said he was going to help Saudi defend themselves from aggression from Yemen. So this, in a sense, poses a challenge to the Biden regime, whether they can avoid escalation in this type of situation. And one of the ways they might do that is perhaps to bring about some change of regime in Saudi Arabia. But there's going to be some sort of face-saving measure they'll look for to try and back out of the bad situation that Riyadh is in.
Thank you very much, Mr. John Stepling, author and commentator, joining us from Norway, and also Mr. Tim Anderson, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies from Sydney. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us on this edition of the News Review. Welcome back. Iran has started the clinical trial of its domestically developed coronavirus vaccine. Two volunteers received a Razi-Cov Pars vaccine doses during a ceremony attended by government officials in Tehran. A total of 133 volunteers will gradually receive injections during the first human trial stage. The results will be analyzed and reported to the health ministry. Cov Pars, developed at Iran's Razi Vaccine and Serum Research Institute, is administered both through injection and inhalation. It is the second indigenously developed COVID vaccine currently under clinical trial. The achievement comes as the country faces difficulties in importing COVID-19 vaccines due to U.S. sanctions. The United States has approved a third coronavirus vaccine for emergency use days after the death toll from the pandemic in the country topped 500,000. The Food and Drug Administration said the single-shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine is highly effective at preventing severe COVID cases. That is amid concerns over the vaccine's only 72% efficacy in clinical trials. The figure falls significantly short of the earlier approved vaccines that have over 90% efficacy. President Joe Biden has, however, hailed the approval of the new vaccine as exciting news, but he warned against Americans letting their guard down. COVID-19 has infected an average 69,000 people in the U.S. over the past week. That is a plateau authorities are trying to break with new jabs. The U.S. remains the world's worst affected country by the pandemic, both in terms of infections and deaths. Now, Brazil's health ministry reports over 1,300 new coronavirus deaths for the fifth day in a row. The country also registered nearly 62,000 infection cases over the past day. Brazil has suffered an enduring second wave since November, and infection rates have not begun to fall. The country imposed lockdown measures in the capital city, Brasilia, to combat the surge in cases. According to official data, the country has so far registered more than 10.5 million infections since the pandemic began, with nearly 255,000 deaths. Elsewhere in Latin America, Mexico logged over 750 new fatalities. raising its total death toll to over 185,000. Meanwhile, Argentina, thousands of people took to the streets of Buenos Aires to protest the VIP vaccine scandal that has shaken up the government. Demonstrators began to bang pots and pans in front of the presidential palace and carried signs reading, quote, "Give me back my vaccine," and "Vaccines should not be a privilege." Last week, it was revealed that a dozen people had been able to use connections to get access to COVID-19 vaccines. Argentina's total coronavirus infections surpassed the 2 million mark last week. The country has also logged more than 50,000 COVID-19 deaths since the pandemic began. EU leaders have expressed concern over the spread of COVID-19 variants so within the 27-nation bloc, amid criticism that vaccines are being administered too slowly. The handling of the pandemic in the EU is contributing to the economic uncertainty and social inequality. Jerome Hughes reports.
Like millions of other young people in the EU, Charles Prevost feels he has not been given adequate support by authorities during the pandemic. In order to survive, the entrepreneur has purchased his own hot dog stand, which he operates in Brussels.
I was working on a restaurant. I was managing a restaurant and I lost my job and I was like, what I can do next, what we can do, what the young people, the young men, the young ladies in this world, in this city, in this country, what they can do because we don't have any help.
As businesses continue to fold in the EU and millions lose their jobs, people feel there is no hope. Only 6.4% of the bloc's population have received a vaccine. That's tiny compared to the UK and US. A two-day video conference involving EU leaders has just concluded. They are very concerned about COVID-19 mutations.
The B.1.1.7 is by now in all member states but one. The South African variant is in 14 member states and the Brazilian variant in 7. So there's a lot of challenge ahead of us.
Variants are allowed to flourish when people are not vaccinated. Experts say the bureaucratic structures of the EU have resulted in citizens having to wait far too long for vaccines. However, EU leaders say producers are not keeping their promises in terms of supply.
We want more predictability and transparency to ensure that pharmaceutical companies comply with their commitments.
Health officials warn mixed messages from EU leaders about the efficacy of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine are making citizens reluctant to take the jab. Two other vaccines have been approved here, but supply remains a big problem. A fourth vaccine from Johnson & Johnson is likely to be approved next month. During their summit, EU leaders talked at length about the importance of developing certificates to show people have been vaccinated in order to open up travel. Commentators are describing this as laughable, saying it is putting the cart before the horse, given the current state of play with respect to the rollout of vaccines. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Fresh protests are held in the Spanish city of Barcelona as the unrest over the jailing of Catalan singer Pablo Hasél shows no sign of abating. Protesters vandalized shops and banks and set trash bins on fire. Police made 10 arrests. Hasél was arrested last week and sentenced to 9 months in jail on charges of glorifying terrorism and insulting the Spanish monarchy in his songs and tweets. The arrest has sparked a debate on the freedom of expression in the country. Now, with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
Welcome back. In the first part of the program, we witness how Detroit, once a thriving industrial hub, is now a mere shell of its former self. With the arrival of competition, Detroit's motor industry collapsed, creating a climate of deep crisis, unemployment, and decline. Now, a wave of crime, foreclosures, and empty, decaying houses plague the city. Yet there are those who still live in Detroit, against all odds, and they're looking for new ways to revive and reinvent the city. Stay with us for the second part of the program.
If you got to live somewhere where it's desolate and it's not being taken care of, if you got to live there, why not take care of it? You live there, you know, it just makes sense to me. It's coming back, man. It's a lot of different areas that are under development right now, a lot of different organizations who have taken the responsibility and not waiting on the city, not waiting on the so-called government or whoever these individuals are. They've just said, hey, look, let's get out, let's take our lawnmowers, let's take our stuff, and let's just clean.
Occupy Detroit has been holding vigil at my home daily, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., to make sure that the dumpster does not get set in front of my home. When Occupy Detroit or the eviction defense team is unable to be here, my neighbors patrol and come by and make sure nothing's going on at the house. It's not just about me anymore. That's what I like, because so many people have come through here who needed help. And the lady across the street, she's like, oh, thank you for doing this, you know. She says, you're helping so many people. And she's like, I need help. And she got it yesterday. She came by to our meeting, and she was able to get the help she needed. So I love it. That's the part I really like. I believe I'm going to keep my house. But either way, knowing that I am helping others, that's good.
Detroit has a lot of businesses leave. They have accumulated a lot of debts because they don't have a tax base, because these businesses have left. And they are in a really bad spot credit-wise. So it seems like you're saying that a lot of the actions that are being taken in Detroit are designed to have Detroit fail.
It's a plan, I think, really from the top that is being perpetuated. All of this stuff that they're doing to us in Detroit is illegal according to the Constitution of the United States and almost any document that supports human rights and civil rights.
We've something called taxation without representation.
Exactly.
We have no representation.
The taxes are taken and then applied as they see fit, and we don't have any say. And as we no longer have a say,
our social services will be cut back to the point that you can move anywhere in the country.
And to get better
anywhere in the country.
Right.
And you can get better service.
That's true.
And so what I'm saying
is, can you get out?
Right. And so I'm saying that as long as it's happening to blacks, you know, it's okay, because we always is the whooping boy on the block. When you ain't got nobody else to whoop and hate, you can always hate and whoop us. But as people are seeing with this foreclosure and eviction that is not just necessarily black. Relegated to black people, now some white people are beginning, and I'm talking about some affluent white people have lost their homes to foreclosure and eviction. And at that point, race doesn't play in that picture anymore.
Seen some plans and seen the way that politics is painting out a future, it's very different than what I would like to see. What I see as a future for Detroit is that the people that have the money will continue to invest in downtown. They will rally the money together to the point that they'll create a gated community downtown. They just want to terraform the city, make it appealing to the tourists and to the people in the suburbs to come get your home in the city, and we'll make it safe for you. We'll make sure there's a gate. We'll make sure those people that you don't want to be around aren't around. We'll create a neighborhood for you. Create this experience that everybody feel, oh, this is utopian.
The Packard plant has to be one of the most infamous ruins in the world. This was where they made Packard automobiles. Right now, the only thing that's moving out of this building are steel beams and scrap metal. It's literally being picked apart. This is 3.5 million square feet, which is huge. You know, I mean, what are you going to do with 3.5 million square feet of structurally unstable, burned out, scrapped factory? I mean, even the concrete is collapsing. I mean, but the problem is that being built as a car factory, it's built like a tank. So it would cost millions and millions of dollars to tear down something that big and that sturdy. So there's no money to tear it down. There's no real interest to tear it down because the neighborhood around it has already died. So it just sits. It's sometimes hard to believe standing here that you are standing in the middle of the world's greatest nation, that, you know, America's a land of prosperity, and this is part of it. I mean, it's, I don't think that you'll find that many people who would say they want this place to stick around, you know. I just want it to go away.
I just do my own thing. I don't really worry that much about city politics. Of course, it definitely affects me. But if I had to worry about city politics, I wouldn't be able to get out of bed in the morning. I mean, what are you going to do? I started in 2008 as a 48-square-foot stand downtown Detroit. And in 2009, I moved here. 2010, I expanded. 2011, I opened up one in Grosse Pointe, Michigan. And then 2012, I'm actually opening up a bar right on the corner of this building. And so I'll have two shops in Detroit. People are going to look back on this time in Detroit right now, 2012. You know, the media could say what they want to say. If you are smart, you are opening a business right now. That negative idea of Detroit, yeah, it's not a perfect city, but the ones who know, who have actually come here, who actually can are on feet on the ground, actually see that there's a lot of young people, there's a lot of people starting up shop, you know, and I can honestly say, 5 years from now, it'll be a whole different story. Like, this area will be booming. I can really see it. It's already starting now. It's already happening. When I first moved into this building, it was just me and Wasabi. Then there was a bookstore. Then there was a cafe. Then there was a t-shirt shop and another shop. And I'm doing a bar. You know what I'm saying? So it all kind of, that's how it starts. You know, what other city can you do something like that? It's crazy, but it's, I don't know. It's just like something crazy and fun and, you know, I don't know. And people around here probably would think I was crazy, but people probably thought, you know, making crepes in Detroit was crazy, so who cares? You know, I don't know. I just think that, I don't know, you know, I mean, because the people that are already living here, maybe they are disenfranchised and everything like that, but we got to start somewhere. You can't just say, I'm disenfranchised, woe is me. If you're disenfranchised, you have to pick yourself up, and there comes a time when you have to say, okay, I have to, hi, take things into my own hands and be the master of my own life. And I know that's hard for someone who has been beaten down all their life, but there's no one that's coming in to save us. You know, we gotta save ourselves. And, you know, so for me, I do see it as a blank slate. I know that I'm gonna be ripped apart for saying that, but, you know, what else do you call this? Where, you know, okay, here's the opportunity, here it is. Okay, it's out there for the taking. Go. Are you going to take the opportunity? Are you not? I mean, I don't know. That's my.
Detroit is a city that was really built around one industry, which is the motor industry, and obviously that failed. And even though the automakers are doing well right now, having a city based on one industry is a setup for failure. Some people think we all need to go back to the land and everyone needs to be a farmer. I don't think that would be a solution for the whole city either. I think it's going to have to be bits and pieces of a lot of different things and have a more varied city than just relying on one occupation.
And we have to go past, you know, the post-industrial without just throwing it all away. And so how do we find that groove of being in an industrial society, but not feeling like we're trapped by it, not feel like that we're being wounded by it, not feel like we're being enslaved by it. A lot of what's happening here is healing, and I see a lot of that happening around here, and that's the beauty of what's happening.
Even myself, man, you know, when I see something that's not good around here, I challenge it, you know. And it's not to say that I'm some type of superman or a super individual. It's just we know what's right, and so we stand for what's right. And if I see something that's not right, I'm going to say, hey, man, we ain't going for that. You got to move that, you know. And out of the respect of them seeing us working and all of the work that we're doing, they kind of go, oh, man, that's the brother, you know. Let's get on out of here, you know. And then they themselves, they need that inspiration. They need to see someone that looks like them, their age, saying, man, if he could do it, I could do it, you know.
We've sectioned off the front two-thirds of this container for living space and kitchen. So the first step we've done is to cut out parts of the walls and frame windows so we have light and ventilation. After that, we'll have to put a roof over the top to collect water. We'll have a wood-burning stove for heat, solar panels for electricity, and just basic essentials, whatever we can fit into the small space. I plan to live in this container on my own, at least for a season. It'll be essentially a basic rustic cabin in the woods. After that, it'll also be a great space for interns who come to work on the farm, a place for visitors to stay. And in the long run, we'd like to get one of the houses on this block and rehab it so we have a bigger space.
A lot of eyes are on Detroit now, and a lot of the images that people are seeing of Detroit are these ruins of Detroit, but it's not all abandoned. Not every house has a tree growing out of the roof. I think one of Detroit's biggest challenges in turning things around is changing the perception around the world that there's no one left in the city. There's nothing but abandoned buildings. It's just not true.
I
I haven't been getting any sleep. I thought that I was okay, but apparently I'm too restless, you know, to just lay back and get some really needed sleep.
When I filed my lawsuit, it was just crazy to me that here I come, I don't have an attorney, I'm representing myself. I had two huge law firms coming against little old me. And that, instead of making me feel small and afraid, it just made me feel like, okay, I must be something and I must be on the right track if I got two huge law firms coming against me and I know nothing about the law. All I know is morals and I feel, you know, you took my money, give me my house. It's a simple thing. You know, all you had to do is use a little ink and add my name to the mortgage and we wouldn't be going through this right now.
To me that when a group of people cleaned up this place the way that this group of people did and have put countless hours into making a community, to just say leave. We're not asking the taxpayers to support us, we're going to support one another. And for the government then to come in and say, well, we're going to take that away from you, it's devastating.
Qualified for the subsidy, thank God, which only 25% of the people that live here did qualify for. So I get my rent paid for a year in a one-bedroom apartment, which is really all I need. As long as I can save money, in a year I'll be in a much better position than I am now. You know, so I'm grateful for it, but it doesn't do anything to solve the problem of homelessness, you know. And homelessness is not a crime. Like tomorrow when they come down here to take everybody to jail and steal everybody, you know, it's criminalizing the act that you're homeless. It's not, you know, we didn't commit any crimes to be homeless, you know, and they're going to arrest us for being on land that they're never going to use for anything else, that's owned by the state, which is the public, which we are the public, so we should be able to use this land if they're not using it for anything else. They're going to put $60,000 into putting a fence around this place so we can't get back in. That's taxpayer money. The subsidies, the $350,000 that they gave to help maybe 25 people with these subsidies, all that's taxpayer money. You're talking about $500,000 to get rid of us when it costs nothing to leave us here.
It's a bar, restaurant. Basically, I call it, you know, like a David Lynch film as a bar with dancing. So pretty much this is it with about 45% of the construction done. A lot of the rough construction is pretty much done, but come on down. The kitchen space right here, and this is going to be the bar. And just the interior, the furniture, I think it'll be like something that you haven't seen in the city. And if for that matter, you know, in the Midwest, New York, Chicago, I think it's going to be really, really cool. So there it is. You know, I don't want to just have it something that's just good enough for Detroit. It's going to be something that's going to be, that you wouldn't feel out of place in a major city.
So Detroit is one of those cities where, you know, we kind of take a licking and keep on ticking. We've had blow after blow after blow, whether it's the auto industry faltering, plant closures. I mean, you know, we're here, you know, and that's one of the things I love about Detroit. You know, its people are underdogs, and we almost relish being the underdog. You know, we almost kind of like it when people count us out because, you know, we always manage to claw our way back or at least hang in there, you know. I mean, blow after blow, Detroit isn't dead.
Well, perhaps Detroit can be seen as a warning or the very first signs of the dying of capitalism in America. And that's it for this week. Thank you. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. But before we go, remember you can contact us either through email, Facebook, or Twitter. Goodbye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, we send our peace and blessings upon all the prophets of Allah, Subhanahu wa Taala. And especially the last of them, Muhammad al-Mustafa and his progeny, and those companions who followed their path. I'm your host, Sayyid Wahid Alawi, and welcome to another program of For a Better Life, here on IRIB English Radio. We were talking about mental diseases, mental anxiety, which visibly affects all the tasks one performs, and sometimes lead one unconsciously into deviant path and to make irrational responses. when anxiety takes over, we cannot make rational judgments. And when we cannot make rational judgments, that would affect our well-being and others' well-being. Another harm caused by mental worry is that it deprives one of self-confidence. Many people make it their habit to constantly complain regarding their ill fortune and fate and are never satisfied with their life. They imagine that they cannot prosper in life unless all their affairs are set in order and unless they possess considerable wealth and all the means of comfort. They look for happiness in the distant horizons of the future, why they forget the present and the great asset of life, which is the precious moments of today, of now. The precious moments of today were all the time, or most of the time, think about future issues and future problems. But what about the precious moments of today, of the now? For the sake of the future's dreams, for the sake of future dreams, we sacrifice everything. We sacrifice our now. Whereas if we really care for our happiness, we would discover it in plain and peaceful lives, because that which is of basic significance in life is the present. And the future, which appears to be a heaven in our eyes, would assume the appearance of a frightful hell as soon as we reach it. You know, when we start to have a goal in front of us, and when we, as soon as we reach that goal, we think about the next goal, and the next goal after that. Or we try to tell ourselves that as soon as we are done with this particular task, I will do this and that. I will try to self-develop myself. I will try to read some self-help books. But in reality, we get so much indulged in our task that we forget what we are doing. And we forget what we told ourselves. And one task leads to another task. And we forget our family members. We forget our beloved ones. We forget to play with our children, to be with our spouse, to be with our parents, to spend time for ourselves, to go to the gym, take care of our body. We forget all of those things and we just focus on the next task and the next task after that. From stepping up on the stairs of our career, going higher and higher in our career, that would be our main goal.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand there crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? is Allah satisfied?
You know, show me your schedule, dear brothers and sisters. Show me your schedule, and I will tell you what is or what priorities you have in your life. Show me your schedule, and I will tell you what priorities you have in your life. Because when we write down our schedule, it is only those things usually that you write down that happens. If we have a family activity schedule, if we have our children activity schedule, if we have our job schedule, our gym schedule, our spiritual schedule, it is only at that time that we can understand what our priorities are. Thus, I strongly recommend all of you and myself, first of all, to sit down and write down our goals. Let's write down our goals, our minor goals, our major goals, and our daily activities, our daily schedule, and have separate schedules interacting with each other, and even write down the times, the days when you want to spend time with your child, with your parent, with your spouse, for your own time, your physical well-being, your mental and spiritual well-being. Have a schedule for it. If you want to read a book, have a schedule for it. From this time, from till that time, I will read a book for 1 hour a day. That will be 200 to 250 pages a week. Of the 138 hours of the week, I would like to spend 5 to 7 hours on the gym or playing basketball or football, or whatever sport activity you are interested in. That's 7 hours of 168 hours of the week. And if you spend those 7 hours for your physical well-being, you would have spent more time than 90% of the world population on their physical well-being. Because 90% of the population does not spend 7 hours for their physical well-being. Thus, if we really care for our happiness, we will discover it in plain and peaceful lives. Because that which is of basic significance in life is the present. And the future, which appears to be a heaven in some of our eyes, would assume the appearance of a frightful hell as soon as you reach it. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you.
Your mercy, your love is all I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need.
Your love is all I need.
It's all I need.
Your love is all I
need. All I need.
Your love is all I need.
Oh, 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 oh.
Your love is all I need.
Love is all I need.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.